when Paul wrote to the Corinthian brethren in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, as he was concluding his letter, he had these remarks to make to them in verses 8 and 9. That I shall remain in Ephesus until Pentecost. So the likelihood is very strong from that statement that it is certainly from Ephesus that he was writing this letter. And that his intentions were to remain there, as he says, until the time of Pentecost. And the reason that he was going to do that, the reason he was going to remain in Ephesus was because a wide door for effective service has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. Paul says to the Corinthians, I'm going to stay here in Ephesus. I'm going to remain on for a time because there is a door of opportunity. A wide door has opened, he says, for effective service. He writes to the same brethren again over in his second letter, 2 Corinthians, and in chapter 2, and in verses 12 and 13. And he says, now when I came to Troas for the gospel of Christ, and when a door was opened for me and the Lord, I had no rest for my spirit, not finding Titus my brother, but taking my leave of them, I went on to Macedonia. He speaks again here of the fact that at Troas there is an open door. And it's just simply a metaphor for opportunity. And we have this to occur for ourselves as individuals, and it occurs as well to for congregations, that there are open doors. We are so privileged as Christians to have been given the opportunity to serve our God in what is the greatest rescue mission to ever have existed. To rescue people who are lost. To be able to talk to people about the saving gospel of Jesus Christ. It's a privilege to be able to do this. And that's what Jesus was trying to convey to us, I believe, when he spoke those familiar words in that Sermon on the Mount, that you're the light of the world and you're the salt of the earth. He was conveying to us the fact that we are a privileged people because we have these opportunities, these open doors that present themselves to us on an individual basis and a congregational basis. Jesus came to save sinners. And if we follow him, is it any surprise that it should be our concern and would be our the concern of his people to save sinners? To be looking for opportunities to help others learn this saving message? The New Testament calls such opportunities open doors. Well, I want to talk to you about the fact that God does have what I'm calling an open door policy. And I want to speak to you first of all about the way that the Scriptures identify these open doors. And we've looked in 1 Corinthians 16 and in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 where Paul speaks of such occasions or such opportunities. John chapter 10. Verses 1 and following. Part of what Jesus talks about there is the fact, as he says it, I am the door. It is not possible for men and women to come to God into an approved relationship with God absent of a door of entry. There had to be a door, which Jesus was, for us and for anyone else to come to God in order to be saved. And so, not surprisingly, his followers are aware of the doors. Over in the book of Colossians chapter 4 and verses 3 and 4, his apostle, Jesus Christ, takes up this imagery and says, praying at the same time for us as well, that God may open to us a door for the Word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been in prison, in order that I may make it clear in the way that I ought to speak. Do you see Paul, the prisoner, Paul being held by the Romans at this point in time, writing this letter off to the Colossians and instructing them to pray. Pray for me. Pray for me that there might be an open door, that I can speak about the mystery of Christ, the saving mission of Christ, and that I may do it in an effective way, and that I may be able to do so in a way that will convince others. You turn to the book of Revelation in the 3rd chapter, and there we find Jesus again as the speaker. John is recording the things that Jesus reveals to him, particularly in this part of the book, he is writing about the seven churches in Asia. And to the church of Philadelphia, he says in verse 7, "He who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens, says this." Speaking about Jesus. Jesus speaking about Jesus. And John writing says that he, Jesus, is the one who opens these doors. And when he opens them, nobody will be able to shut them. And when he shuts them, nobody will be able to open. Passage to look at is in Acts, the 14th chapter. And in verse 27, we find Luke recording these matters. He says, "And when they had arrived and gathered the church together, they began to report all the things that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles." This is Paul and Barnabas returning from their preaching mission, reporting to the church there in Antioch that had sent them out and had been supportive of their work as they had traveled throughout much of Asia Minor and preached the gospel. And they come back and they are telling of how God had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. Simply that God had made available to the Gentiles in an effective way this message that that would save them. So the metaphor, the open door, the fact of the open door of God is substantiated throughout the Scriptures, throughout the New Testament Scriptures. But we might ask ourselves the question of, well, okay, who opens these doors? As we've just read in Acts chapter 14, verse 27, Paul and Barnabas attributed it to God, that God had opened this door of faith to the Gentiles. 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 12 that we looked at, we find there that the Apostle Paul writes that this door was opened in the Lord. I believe the King James Version says it was opened by the Lord. Colossians 4 and verse 3, it was Paul's instruction to the Colossian brethren that they should pray that God may open a door. And in Revelation 3 and verse 7, as we noted, it was Christ who was speaking, who characterized himself as the one who opens the door, and no one may shut it then. There's no question about the fact that these speak of the opportunities provided by the Lord. You know something? There's something about opportunities that I think we all recognize. We all, in regards to other things, other areas of life, we would surely recognize this. And that is that opportunities are not caught from behind. opportunities must be observed and taken when they present themselves. Once opportunities pass, they're gone. You remember the movie from several years back, Dead Poets Society. And there was this very popular teacher who came to a prestigious private school, and he was a little different, and he didn't necessarily always follow the rules, and that got him in trouble with the administration. But he's very popular with the students. And the young men that were in his class were greatly affected by this teacher. And one of the phrases that he impressed upon their minds, it became really kind of a catchphrase for people around the time that the movie was released, but it was carpe diem. You remember that? Carpe diem. You remember what it means? It's Latin. Seize the day. All in the world that was saying was, you take opportunities as they present themselves. And as we've read in these passages, when Paul was asking the Colossians to pray for him, or when he was telling the Corinthians that the Lord had opened doors for effective service there in Ephesus, all in the world he was saying was, I am committed to taking the opportunities as they appear, not trying to chase them down after they're gone. I fear that some people are of a disposition to let them pass, to sit idly by as opportunities appear and then vanish. It's as I was saying a few moments ago, in the lives of young men who've learned and obeyed the gospel and have become effective parts of this congregation and reliable parts of the work here. It didn't happen by accident. They didn't sit back and say, oh, well, you know, yeah, I'll get around to that one day. Or when the opportunities came, when they were presented, they responded. They seized the day. I fear that there are far more opportunities than there are ones who are willing to seize them. Is this not exactly what Jesus was impressing upon the minds of his disciples there in Matthew chapter 9, in verses 37 and 38, when they looked out across the fields and saw the fields ready to be harvested? And Jesus says, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest. It just seems to me that that's exactly what Jesus is saying, is that there are not as many workers who are willing to seize the opportunity as there are opportunities that need to be seized. No question, it seems to me then, that it's God, clearly, who opens the door. And again, a question may follow that, and that is, how does God open these doors of opportunity? I think the verses that we've looked at make it clear that he does. Honestly, I will tell you that I don't know how he does. It seems that how he does this is shrouded in the mystery of his providence. Psalms 119 may shed a little light on this, at least in one regard. Psalm 119, and in verses 67 through 71, the psalmist says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep thy word. And he goes on through those following verses to talk about how God had taught him to do good and has taught him his statutes. But before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I keep thy word. Other scriptures tell us that God chastises those whom he loves. Hebrews, the 12th chapter. How does God open doors of opportunities to us? Opportunities to serve, opportunities to be more of what he would have us to be? I don't know. It seems as though this is a verse that would tell us that sometimes it may be by afflicting us, by putting us through difficult times. Because he loves us, he will chastise us. Difficulties can change us. Now, that's why we need to not give up on this effort of teaching the truth, of teaching the gospel. Why do you keep doing that? Why do you keep emphasizing, teach the gospel? When so many people will resist it, they'll turn away from it. Well, I'll tell you why. Because things change. As time goes along, things change for people. And people who in the times past, maybe over a period of years, have resisted the truth and have showed no appreciation for it, no inclination to it, things change for them. They get sick. Their loved ones die. They lose their jobs. Hardships come upon them of various kinds. They get a little humbled. Before they were afflicted, they went astray. But then things changed for them. That's why we keep teaching the truth. That's why we keep trying to appeal to people, even when in the past they've turned away. Now, is God always behind such things as illnesses and hardships? And I don't believe he is. I think God gets blamed for a lot of things that he had no part in. But just exactly what God's involved in doing, I can't say. I can't say, no, he didn't do this or he didn't do that with any more certainty than I can say he did do this or he did do that in his providence. But I do believe there's reason for us to be persuaded and to be confident in the fact that he does act in our lives. I have a friend went to college with who wrote me a little while back and was expressing some thoughts that he had come to in his mind, and basically to just kind of boil it all down to the simplest level, basically what he has concluded is that God really is not active in the world today. He believes in the scriptures, inspiration of the scriptures. He believes in the accuracy of the scriptures. But basically, he believes that now, after the age of miracles past, that now God's no longer involved in the affairs of the world. It's really not a new thought at all. It's deism. It's the view that many of the founding fathers of our nation held. Deists. Deists believe that the universe and the world and all is kind of like an alarm clock, and that God wound it up, set it into motion, and then stepped out of the picture, and now everything is up to men to do the best that they can. I'm just not persuaded that that's the case. It seems to me that God remains. Why would in the world would God instruct his people to pray to him? We've sung about prayer. Why in the world do that? Why pray for people who are ill to get well? Why ask God about that? If he stepped out of the picture, he's not going to do anything. And it just becomes a matter of random chance of whether a person gets well or not. I just don't believe the Scriptures affirm that. Rather, I believe the Scriptures affirm what we're talking about this morning, that God is still the God of open doors. He's still the God who opens doors and gives opportunities. Acts the 8th chapter, Acts the 10th chapter, describe to us how God opened doors of opportunity in the lives of people. And I will grant you that there was in at least one instance, there were some miraculous events involved in this. But why in the world are we to conclude that because God no longer works in miraculous ways, as I believe 1 Corinthians 13 affirms, why in the world are we to conclude that therefore God no longer acts? Why are we to conclude that He doesn't still today do like He did in these two passages in Acts? And it gets a teacher, someone who understands God's message, in connection to a person who's looking to learn God's message. Acts the 8th chapter, he got Philip to that man along the desert road there, the Ethiopian eunuch. That man who was searching, who was reading from the book of Isaiah, who needed someone to help him, God got the man there who could do it. And in Acts chapter 10, he had Peter go to the house of Cornelius. Cornelius, who was looking for truth, who wanted to hear the words whereby he and his house could be saved. God got the man there who could do it. Why are we to conclude that God no longer, in His providence, works circumstances in our lives so that someone who knows His saving message can get to the person who wants to know it and teach them? He's still the God of open doors. But I want to tell you something. We've got to be willing to step through those doors when they are opened to us. How do you enter the door? Well, it has a lot to do, an awful lot to do with one's attitude. I think about John chapter 4 and Jesus' encounter with the woman at the well, and how after a day of travel, he's become tired and thirsty. He sent his disciples off into town to buy some food. And while they're gone, he encounters this woman at the well and asks her for a drink of water and engages her in a conversation about water that is eternal, that will satisfy her spiritual needs in an eternal way. And in verses 34 and 35, it says, Jesus said to them, his disciples have now returned. They're perplexed that their master would have anything to do with this Samaritan woman. And he says to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. He sent them off for some food to eat. But now, in light of the circumstances that have arisen, the opportunities, the doors that had been opened through it, and something negative is said, some kind of opposition arises. Oh, it's the last time I'm going to walk through that kind of a door. Is that the way we're going to be? Do you remember what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 9? That there was a door open to him there in Ephesus. And the last statement he makes in that 9th verse is, there are many adversaries. There are a lot of people that are going to oppose what he would do in Ephesus. In the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, in fact, when he was writing about the subject of resurrection, he makes the observation that he had fought wild beasts in Ephesus. I don't think for a moment that he's talking about he had to kill a lion or he had to kill a tiger there in Ephesus. I believe he's talking about there were beastly men who had opposed his work. But you know what he said? He said, I'm going to stay right here in Ephesus for a while because there's a door of opportunity here. And even if it meant facing adversaries and paying a price, he would do so. Think about his actions sometime before writing that letter to Corinth. Going back to those early days when he and Barnabas set out on that preaching trip and they crossed the island of Cyprus. And the book of Acts doesn't indicate that there was a great kind of response to their preaching. They were able to convert the governor there, Sergius Paulus. That was a good thing, certainly. But they had to face that evil man named Bar-Jesus, who did everything he could to undermine their influence with Sergius Paulus. And they went on in their trip, and they got up into Asia Minor, and they went to Perga and to Pamphylia and to Antioch and to Iconium and to Lystra, oftentimes being run out of those towns by opponents. When they got to Lystra, the Jews, Lystra was a town that had no synagogue in it. They didn't even have 10 Jewish men who would come together to form a synagogue. The Jews of Iconium and Antioch weren't even evangelistic enough to go down there to Lystra and to establish a synagogue. But when Paul passed through their towns and they opposed him and he went on down then to Lystra, well, they were willing to go then so that they could oppose this man. Don't think for a moment that passing through a door of opportunity won't have its cost and won't require us to pay a price sometimes. But you know, when all is said and done, Paul's journey there through that part of the world, Scripture says that all Asia heard the word. I don't know how God opens all these doors, but I do believe firmly that He does, and that we need to be ready, we need to be willing to step through those doors. And if we're not willing to take up our responsibilities to take advantage of these opportunities, then that's going to say something about our spiritual condition. There are four kinds of people. I came across this description. Four classes of people. There are ones who don't know what is happening. There are those who watch what is happening. There are those who criticize what is happening. And there are those that make things happen. Now, I don't mean by that to suggest that, well, we'll do this on our own. Don't need God's help. Don't need anyone. But there is a sense in which people who will walk through doors of opportunity are the kinds of people who make things happen. They accomplish things. They achieve things. And in this instance, we're talking about achieving and accomplishing the things of God. Will we do that as a group? Will we do that as an individual? The doors are there. The doors are open. It's just a matter of whether or not we'll walk through them. Are you not a child of God? Are you one who's never obeyed the gospel, one who is not a Christian? Then today we urge you to become one and would tell you the same things that those men we've talked about, Paul and Barnabas and others, we would tell you the same thing that they would tell you. In the Scriptures, they preached many sermons that you can read. And what they told men and women to do in order to become Christians was to believe in Jesus, that He's the Son of God. And in that faith, to confess their sins, to turn away from those sins, to confess that Jesus is the Son of God, and to be baptized, washing the guilt of their sins away. And if you would do that today, you'll become nothing more and nothing less than a Christian. And we hope that you'll do that while we stand and sing.